If you please take your seats, we'll get started with our second period this morning, again with Brother Jay Johnson.
So, Nehemiah hears a report about the land of Judah and about Jerusalem. And we might ask, why is he was motivated to go and do this? Because it says in Nehemiah 1:3 that he heard that the remnant was in great affliction, and that Jerusalem, and really the people themselves, were a reproach. And so I think, to some extent, it's hard for us to mentally understand how it is that that's sufficient to drive someone to do what Nehemiah did. And I think that the problem is that we ourselves are not, we don't have ties to a city like they did, which was their center of worship, and which, when it was brought to ruins, was a reproach. It was a reproach to them. They no longer had the standing. They no longer were able to consider themselves in the same light that they had before. The idea that they were in great affliction, I think, also seems to imply the mistreatment of the returned Jews by other people that were in the land due to a lack of respect or for their outright hatred of them. Their temple has now been built by the time of Nehemiah, and their temple is a lesser version of the original. And their capital city, where the temple is still in ruins. So not only would the Jewish population be subject to mistreatment by other inhabitants of the land, they would have no spirit to combat it. This is the thing that Nehemiah hoped to remedy by rebuilding the walls in a community effort. Sanballat and Tobiah reflect the contempt that the Jews face. The Jews and any efforts that they might have to build a community spirit had the kinds of thinking in Sanballat and Tobiah to face. And it would not be difficult. You know, if you just think about going back as they did, they'd spent 70 years in Babylon. So many of the oldest people died while they were there. Younger people grew up and knew nothing but Babylon, and there were some old enough that would be able to remember where they came from and would have some way to make a comparison when they returned. So when they get back to the land and they're moving in, it's not the same. Things have changed in that period of time. The land initially was theirs to do with as they pleased. Oh, sure, they did not get rid of all of the inhabitants of the land that they should have the first time around, and they had, that was indeed part of the problem that caused them to end up in Babylon. But nonetheless, it was theirs. It was the place that God had given to them. And now they're in a position where there's all these other people there. And they've been there longer than these returning people. And they, of course, have their own feelings about who is in charge and who owns things and who should be calling the shots. I put this up. This is a depiction in the darker shade is what the wall is thought to be in the time of Nehemiah. all of the gates and whatnot that are there, I don't think there is anybody that knows that either. It's somebody's best guess. Most of that's been destroyed, and they do, you know, they find archaeological traces of these things, but the gates that were there are not the gates that are there today. They're different gates altogether. But it gives you some idea of the gate, the walls and the gates and the size of the project that they were going to undergo. An interesting thing to do is to take a look at Nehemiah 3 at your leisure. This lists all the people and the gates and the places that they did their work and repaired. In some cases, it appears that some people took a couple of places to work on. But in any case, there were 41 individuals or groups of people who took part in the repair and the building effort. So even if you cut it into equal pieces of 42 people around that entire wall, you could see they had a sizable workforce ready to go and do the work that Nehemiah had in mind for them. Now, there is a saying in science that nature abhors a vacuum. And so do my cats, but that's another story. So wouldn't you know, an Ammonite, a Moabite, and an Arabian rise to prominence while the Jews are captives in Babylon. There's Sanballat, the Horonite, and a Horonite is an inhabitant of Horonaim, which means that he was a Moabite. There is Tobiah, the servant, the Ammonite. There's Geshem, the Arabian, mentioned in Nehemiah 2:19. Sanballat's brethren that he talks about in Nehemiah 4:2, the army of Samaria that he also mentions in Nehemiah 4:2, and the Ashdodites, and actually there's a couple others that come up in the narrative. But these are people who are not happy with Nehemiah's ideas here. And so they go about to try and stop it. First of all, they have a threat of war. Now, I think this is an interesting thing because these are the steps that Nehemiah took as he outlines them in Nehemiah 4. First, he prayed to God. Secondly, he set a watch to watch for whoever might come to cause problems. He armed the people, gave them spears or bows and swords. Nehemiah encouraged the people by talking to them, appealing to their sense of duty to God and their duty to each other. He worked with, and all of them did, worked with one hand, carrying a weapon in the other hand, they worked. And then for safety purposes, they all lodged in Jerusalem and remained ready such that they didn't remove their clothing except to wash. So when I look at this, I say, how is this different than what we should be doing? When we look at this, we too are to watch. We are to pray. We are to be armed, but of course our armor is more in terms of how Paul terms it, the whole armor of God. And if you want to turn over to Ephesians 6, just to look at this again, it's funny how when you read things again in some other context, it just sort of has a different flavor to it. So Ephesians 6 at verse 11, put on the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand the wiles of the devil. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against the spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day. And having done all to stand, stand therefore, and having your loins girt about with truth, and having on the breastplate of righteousness, and your feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking the shield of faith, wherewith ye shall be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked, and take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, praying always in all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, and watching thereunto with all perseverance and supplication for all saints. These are things that we should do, and we should keep this in our mind, because this is something that we do, or we shouldn't be doing, just once in a while. The idea is the same idea as those people. They were there every day to do this. And so that's the way we should look at it. It's something that is part of what we should be doing every day. And so it's necessary for us to read our Bibles and to be competent in the Word, reading the Word, being in touch with it, so that we don't forget and decide that we can lean onto our own understanding, which will not work out well. One of the things about doing this, which I think is also good, is that this threat of war did never materialize. They took these steps, they were prepared, and it became known to their enemies that they were prepared. And so they never took the opportunity to try and see if they could actually cause some havoc. And that's because, for the most part, and we'll see that in the next slide as well, the thing that is happening here is it's an attempt to cause us to faint, to cause us to feel like we can't do it, that we are fearful, we're afraid, and therefore we won't attempt to do it. As you recall, the children of Israel, when they came out of Egypt and came to the promised land, they sent the spies in and they came back. And they decided not to go in, not because they had suffered a defeat in any sort of war or anything at all. It was all a matter of being afraid and not having faith that God could help them through whatever the particular problem might be. The idea that they lodged in Jerusalem, I think, is interesting too. We can see the practical aspect of that, but we ourselves, in a spiritual sense, need to do the same sort of thing. It's the city of peace, and that's where we would like to be. We don't have a Jerusalem, but we do have a Prince of Peace, and that is where we are supposed to take our consolation. That is where we are supposed to feel safe and feel competent and protected. And finally, the idea that they remained ready, removing their clothes only to wash them. That reminds us of the five wise virgins who also were always at the ready. They did fall asleep, but when they awoke, everything was at the ready, and they could go about the business that they were to go about. Now let's take a look. There were not only threats against the people, but later, at the time that the walls were already repaired, but there weren't any gates up yet, then the threats moved to Nehemiah specifically. Because now the idea was, if there was some way they could take him out of the equation as the leader of these people, and thinking him to be the cohesion that kept everything going, then that would be a way to defeat the purpose. So the first idea was that he would be invited to some secluded meeting, and Nehemiah didn't go because he knew that they were out to do him some sort of as he called it, mischief. His reply was, "I'm doing a great work. I don't have time for meetings with you. I must be about the job that I have." There were four attempts in this manner to get him to come out and be alone with his adversaries. On the fifth try, they sent him a letter where it was implied that he was planning a revolt, that he was trying to make himself a king and no longer pay tribute to the Persian government. And the implication was not that Tobiah and Sanballat themselves were going to do anything, but it was pretty obvious that somebody was liable to send a report to the king, and he would be in big trouble. So he should meet, and they could talk it over. But again, he recognized this as a plan just like the plans before. It was a plan to cause fear, a way to get Nehemiah to break down and not go about the job that he had. Then, strangely, Shemaiah prophesies that he should come to the temple and he should remain there because they are seeking his life and this would be the thing that he should do. And Nehemiah, again, now determines that what has happened is that this prophecy is a prophecy that has been paid for by his enemies and that this is not what should be done at all. And of course, he doesn't do it. He doesn't go to any of these places at all. And so the repair of the wall and the gates are put up, and all of it is finished in 52 days in Elul, which is the sixth month. It's finished in 52 days, and that is a pretty remarkable thing. I think the idea that anything like that, even today, with all their machinery and whatnot, could be done in 52 days. Well, they would have to pay overtime, and they would have to do other things, too, that would not be so good. But these people did it. They finished it in 52 days. So now, the next section here that I'd like to look at is this idea of changing fear to joy, because they have gone through a trial. They have started about this business of the repair of the gates. They've all worked together. They've kept together, and they've finished it. And it's like a lot of things in life. We have certain things that we get involved in, that we find it enjoyable. We get to the end of it. It's completed. Then what? Then what do we do? How do we keep that? I mean, we think about that when we come to Bible schools. We come to a Bible school, we are energized. There's some brother or some sister that says something that gets our juices going, and we think, yeah, that's great. But then when we leave the Bible school, how do we keep things going? Well, that, of course, was Nehemiah's problem. It didn't solve every problem just to get the walls completed and everything done. What do you do after that? Well, one of the things is the people decided that they needed to have Ezra come and read the scripture. And Ezra did. He came and read and conveyed the meaning. And that happened as well with the people that were with him. They helped him convey the meaning to the people. It was, as I mentioned, completed in the month Elul, which is the sixth month. So the seventh month comes, and the first day of the month is the Feast of Trumpets. And the people gathered, and they kept although it doesn't talk about the Feast of Trumpets, it does talk about the fact that they were gathered together on the first day and they're read from the Scriptures. Also in that month is the Feast of Tabernacles. And Ezra, in his reading, read about the Feast of Tabernacles. And so the people were inspired to keep it. They read about the fact that they dwelt in booths. And so they decided that's what they needed to do. So they all went out, got their palm fronds, they got their branches from the various trees, and they made themselves booths in which to celebrate this feast throughout the 7 days of the feast. The people also got together to confess their sins as a group, to realize that they had been, and their history had always been one of God doing them well and then them doing God ill. And that had happened over and over again. And here they were at a time where they were in a position to confess their own sins. And then what to do about it? Well, they made a covenant. And there is a chapter in Nehemiah that deals with the covenant that they made. They wrote in it what it was that they were going to do, and essentially they were going to keep the law as it had been given to them. They were going to make provisions for people who were the Levites, bring in the tithe according to the law. Because let's face it, if you have your priesthood and you want to begin all these things again, the priests do not exist except the people are willing to go along with it because they are fed by the people. The people are not willing to do it, then they have no way to exist. So they decide that they're going to do that. They're going to make provision for their singers. They're going to make provision for everyone in accordance with the way that God originally established it. And then they sign the covenant, and all of the people that signed it are listed also in Nehemiah. So that they, as a group, put together their understanding of who they are as a people, what they've been through, and where it is they plan to go. And they've done this as a group. As a group. Then they populate Jerusalem because now they put up all the walls. They have a temple there, but things are not good inside the walls. And there's nobody, because it was in ruins, there wasn't really much of anybody living there. So now they have to determine who is going to be in this city. If it's going to be a great city again, they're going to have people living in it. So the priests and the Levites go there. They choose 1 in 10 people to live in the city. And those that end up going into Jerusalem, they consider blessed. And finally, they dedicate, I'm not sure this is finally, but they dedicate the wall in praise to the Almighty. Now, I don't know, have you've gone through Nehemiah, if any of you have before, you put in your head how this dedication went about. I mean, what did they do exactly? They go on the wall, there's two companies. I used to think that what they did was they were in two companies, they went in opposite directions, they went around the wall, and then they met. And but reading it again, I'm kind of thinking that isn't exactly what happened. There were two groups, for sure. But if you will, turn to Nehemiah 12, and we'll look at verse 40. So stood the two companies of them at that gate, two companies of them, that gave thanks in the house of God, and I and half the rulers with me, and the priests, Eliakim, Maaseiah, Miniamin, Micaiah, Elioenai, Zechariah, and Hananiah with trumpets. And Maaseiah, and Shemaiah, and Eleazar, and Uzai, and Jehohanan, and Malchijah, and Elam, and Ezer. And the singers sang loud with Jezrahiah, their overseer. Also that day they offered great sacrifices and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. The wives also and the children rejoiced, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard afar off. Well, when you go back to the part where he talks about who is in each company, then he talks about where they went. And let's go back to this. So he talks about how the one group begins down here by the... the dung gate on the south, and then the fountain gate, and then comes up along here, and then we don't hear much of anything else. The other group, he talks about them being at the tower of the furnaces, or the tower of the ovens, at the valley gate area here, going along the broad wall, and the old gate, and the fish gate, and the tower of Hananel, and then being standing still at the prison gate, which is not on here. But it would seem to me that what actually happened is that they fanned out the people along the wall on both sides, and then that's when they sang loud and brought this joy to all these people, rather than just marching around and ending up at some place and saying what it was done. It was like they were on the wall to sing and give praise and joy to the Almighty. Yeah.
Brother Jack.
Yes.
It might be interesting to everybody to realize that if you go to Jerusalem today, you can see a portion of this wall which has been dug up and exposed, and know that this is the part of it. It's up in the northwest corner. It's near what's called the Cardo of Jerusalem, or the heart of Jerusalem. And it's up in the, what's the Muslim quarter now. But this wall is exposed, and you go over a structure above it, and you can look down on it and see the way it was constructed and everything. It's really incredible.
All right. Well, I finished much too early here. 20 minutes left. So, anybody got any questions or thoughts that they would like to bring up at this time? Besides Brother Harold. Again, this whole idea of bringing joy and praise to the Almighty is it's interesting, because I've been involved in some classes over the last couple of years where this was done, where if we let's see here, we have. Maybe it was here. No. Well, let's take a look at Okay. In 2 Chronicles 5, take a look here. Let's begin here, verse 2. Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and the heads of the tribes, the princes of the fathers' houses of the children of Israel unto Jerusalem to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah out of the city of David, which is Zion. And this was a great procession. The temple had now been completed, and this was the procession that was beginning at this time. And I think it's interesting to, as I had mentioned before, to compare this to there was a dedication of the second temple, there was a dedication of the wall. And I know in the past I've sort of just read over this without really thinking about what actually happened. To think about what you would hear and what you would see on that day, and to think about what people were feeling. That there was, a great swelling up of love for God on this particular occasion, and the fact that all of this was happening just would be a very powerful thing to all of the people in attendance. So they were going to bring up the Ark of the Covenant out of the city of David, which is in Zion. Because as we recall, David had taken the Ark of the Covenant and had placed it there until there was a temple built for it. Something that he had thought to do himself, but was given to his son Solomon to do. And all the men of Israel assembled themselves, verse 3, unto the king at the feast, which was in the seventh month, once again. And all the elders of Israel came, and the Levites took up the ark, and they brought up the ark, and the tent of meeting, and the holy vessels that were in the tent. These did the priests and the Levites bring up. And King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel that were assembled unto him were before the ark, sacrificing sheep and oxen that could not be counted for number, nor numbered for multitude. And the priests brought in the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah into its place, into the oracle of the house, to the most holy place, even under the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread forth their wings over the place of the Ark, and the cherubim covered the Ark and the staves thereof above. And the staves were so long that the ends of the staves were seen from the Ark before the oracle, but they were not seen without. And there it is unto this day. There was nothing in the ark save the two tables which Moses put there at Horeb when Yahweh made a covenant with the children of Israel when they came out of Egypt. And it came to pass when the priests were come out of the holy place, for the priests that were present had sanctified themselves and did not keep their courses. And the Levites, who were the singers, all of them, even Asaph, Heman, Jeduthun, and their sons and their brethren, arrayed in fine linen, with cymbals and psalteries and harps, stood at the east end of the altar, and with them 120 priests, sounding with trumpets. It came to pass, when the trumpets and the singers were as one, to make one sound to be heard in praising and thanking Yahweh, and when they lifted up their voice with the trumpets and cymbals and instruments of music and praised Yahweh, saying, "For he is good, for his loving kindness endureth forever," that then the house was filled with a cloud, even the house of Yahweh, so that the priest could not stand to minister by reason of the cloud, for the glory of Yahweh filled the house of God. Now, one of the things that was done in the past was brothers took a look at the Psalms, like the Psalms of Asaph in particular, and looked at those in terms of what Psalms might have been sung. One of the things I had thought about when I was putting this class together was that when they did the dedication for the temple, the second temple, in the time of Zerubbabel and Joshua, they did the same thing. They sang, as we read earlier. They sang, and the priests were arrayed as they should be. And when they came out, then I often wondered, what is it they sang? Our brother Carson had talked about Psalm 48, and that was one. That was one psalm that came to mind to me, because I wondered if that was partly the reason that on that occasion the older people who had seen the other temple wept, because all they had at this point, I should say, when I'm talking about the dedication, it was the dedication that they had at the time that the foundation was laid before they completed the temple. When they had that particular dedication, in that the foundation had been laid, it was a good and remarkable point in time that they had come to, and something good that they had completed. But it was not the temple; it was only the foundation. And it would bring to mind in those who were there to celebrate, those who were old enough, what the situation was prior, the glory of the temple that was now in ruins and only now had a foundation in their time. So anyway, these are things that I think are worthy to think about in terms of getting some feeling of exactly what was going on at the time that these events occurred. Because it's just easy to read that they had trumpets, that they had psalteries and harps, and not come to have any feeling about what it is that was actually occurring on that particular date. Brother Harold.
I'm sorry to speak up again, but there's a really, really close parallel to what's happening in the land today. See, this was the first restoration. And the second restoration is happening right now, and the events of this restoration are exactly parallel to what happened in this one. The authority is not the king anymore, it's the United Nations that gave the land, that gave them permission to go back. The opponents of the PLO and the Hezbollah and Hamas and all those people, opposition to the land, it's exactly the same course of events. And of course now you're beyond today as far as this era is concerned. But the same kind of thing will happen. There will be singing at the institution of the temple in the future, and it will be glorious, and the people will know that the Lord's God.
Yes, that's a good point, and that's one of the reasons that I had called this the Israel and the superpowers, because it is very much the same today as it was back then. They are in the midst of... They have a land. It's interesting because, as you went through the other night, the idea that they have a land that was given to them back in 1917, the Balfour Declaration, and then in 1922, where it was set up, but actually part of it was removed and given to what is now Jordan. But a land that was supposed to be set aside. In fact, if you read the Balfour Declaration, that's exactly what it says. It is a land for the Jewish people. And it's set up differently than land that was carved out for Syria and Iraq and whatnot. It was a different setup altogether. And yet, the idea now is that they don't want to do that, the nations around. So there's that tugging, just like in the time of Nehemiah and Ezra, this tugging by these other outside influences that have more power, that have control over situations. Israel is in charge of itself, but it still looks to the United States and other powers to help them out should things turn bad. And of course, that has to change. They have to turn to the Heavenly Father at some point here. and find their real source of strength and power. Any other thoughts? Or if not, I think we'll do we have somebody to offer prayer at some point here?
One more class, so I'm glad you.
Pardon? Oh, that's right. Another class. I'm going way too fast here.
You can do it too,
Jay. All right. Well, I am allowing you to go on your break here until we get to the next class.